Hey everyone, welcome to Sadie's Seats. I'd like to give a warm welcome to wife and husband, Rachel and Derek, also known as the Heretics. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, it's so nice to see you.
It's nice to see you.
My husband will be joining me in just a second. So,
and thank you guys so much for taking time. I really appreciate this.
Yeah.
I love the name Heretics. It sounds like heroic to me. tell me a little bit about that name and what inspired this project.
Yeah, so it's really funny when we started. So I'm a religion major. So I am completing up my bachelor's degree, and I'm moving on to my master's in religion at a secular university. And so I've just been like learning so much more about different understandings in the Bible than what's normal. and my husband's been on his journey too in doing that. And so when we started posting more stuff about things that we've been finding out on Facebook and stuff, we often got called heretics, and the things that we were sharing were heresy, which is really funny to us because when you actually look at early church history, it's in agreement with what we're sharing. So when we kind of wanted to like make an Instagram to kind of share all of these findings that we've been discovering and, you know, researching and looking into, it just was super natural to like take on that ownership of like being called a heretic, because it's kind of like one of those things, like a lot of people were saying it behind our backs anyway. So it was like, why don't we just bring it to light, take ownership of what people already think anyway, and just kind of run with it. So, but it's actually, heretic is a really cool meaning, in that it just is essentially the kind of against the grain, kind of like a rebellious thing. It's not wrong. A lot of people think that the term heretic is you're inherently wrong. It's just challenging the status quo, I guess is what you would call it. So
sure. I think it's a great way that what you guys have done, how you guys are expressing this project. It's a great way to expose the unhealthy aspects about Christianity and just kind of highlight and bring awareness to many people who have the same thoughts. So to join in a space, a sacred, safe space, of course, you know, resistance is gonna come from by a different lower vibrational place, you know? But I think what you guys are doing is amazing. So I really appreciate you guys educating the community on this level.
I really having a good time doing it. So
do you guys identify as Christians?
So that's kind of like, my husband would be the first to say like, yes, he identifies as a Christian. He'll be here in a second. He's just right back there. but for me, that's kind of more of a loaded term. And I was having a conversation with one of my friends recently that for me, knowing what I know and all the research that I've done, it is a very loaded term, you know, Christian. And something that, yes, I still love Jesus. Yes, I still believe that he is God. But as far as identifying as Christian is more or less hard for me, because I don't want to lump myself into the really unhealthy mindset that is evangelical American Christianity today. So I wouldn't openly say that I am one, but it's something that I still, yes, at the end of the day, like if it's black and white, yes or no, yes, I do identify as one, but it's not information that I would be very willing to give up off the bat in conversation.
And that's totally understandable to take the core principles, or some of the core principles and value systems and belief that Christianity does stand for. You know, I think that there's along the road, society has kind of been brainwashed, or it's kind of been put into society as a sense of power versus yeah. the actual spiritual nature of what God and Jesus is supposed to stand for. So, and yeah, it's really unfortunate that people have went two separate paths with that, you know, and the government or whoever higher powers have, I don't want to get too political here, have had their major hand in religion across the world, you know. Yeah. So, but I feel like people are, I don't know, maybe you can vouch for this or think differently. I feel like people, this is an era, a generation where people are kind of starting to question the status quo and what spirituality means and kind of taking it really back to our roots, you know, and the beginning of time. So that's, I think it's a good thing, but like you guys kind of talk in your guys' project, there has to be a dismantle and a deconstruction mm-hmm. of the programmed mentality and structures that have taken place for hundreds of centuries, you know, and just continuing to be modified according to societies, you know. Right.
And that's something that I struggle with a lot of, you know, very like literal Christians with the word. Well, when we look at the word, it immediately contradicts itself in the creation story. So that's something when you kind of let go of the inerrancy and you allow yourself to really start thinking through things that you wouldn't, because I feel like in a lot of circles in Christianity, you're taught, you know, your thoughts are deceptive. You know, if you feel anger or sadness or depression or anxiety, all of those things are kind of, I don't want to be so blunt, but mind controlled by, you know, the evil one. And so it immediately starts us off with not trusting ourselves, not trusting our instincts, not trusting our hearts, our feelings, our emotions. Yeah. And it's almost like everything is very deceptive. And so you have to like keep your head down, fit it into this very, 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 very narrow mindset of like literal scripture to the T. And so part of deconstruction and what, you know, is really inevitable for a lot of Christians, because the path is so narrow in that evangelical American realm, that there's not room for that questioning. So with going into deconstruction, it's not necessarily walking away from Christianity. It's walking away from like normal thinking, this one path, one way. And it makes room for all of these questions that you never felt like you could ask before. And so a lot of the church just writes it off as heresy, as blasphemy. You know, how can you challenge hell? It's very literal. In scripture, it's right here. How can you challenge, you know, the saved and the lost and all of these things that seem very normal to Christianity? But when you start deconstructing, you start understanding that it's not one way, and that actually there's a lot of beauty in disagreement, and there's a lot of beauty in feeling those emotions and going through that deconstruction way with your emotions. And kind of back to what I was saying a little bit earlier, it's not something that you can force, or not something that, you know, is like a, nobody sits down and is like, all right, I'm going to unlearn what I think is correct, you know?
Right.
So it just kind of happens. Like, it's something that you just stumble into and you look back and you're like, oh my gosh, I have so many unanswered questions. A lot of people find themselves really depressed or really anxious with where they are. And it just, it happens, you know? And I think that there needs to be a space and a reformation in the church to allow those things to happen, because I mean, the church tries to thrive off of being inclusive and, you know, making room for all and accepting and embracing everyone. But in reality, there's not, you know, some churches might be better at this than others. I'm not going to say it's, you know, one way. But the vast majority of the experiences, and, you know, we're only a month old, and just how we put out that church trauma post, just addressing, you know, things that we've seen very blatantly in the church, because I come from an atheist background, so I came in as an adult. So it was kind of easier for me to see ways that it's like, oh, this isn't right. Oh, this is kind of manipulative, yeah. You know? Yeah. So just like giving a voice to a lot of people that don't feel like they can feel that way has been really interesting, because there's not room for that, because you are taught that that's deceptive. You're taught that questioning the institution of the church is you falling away from God, and you know, it's very controlling when you think about it. And my thing at the end of the day, and something that I often tell people who are deconstructing, or, you know, learning to trust their feelings for the first time, or whatever it may be, is if you believe in a God so small that you can't question, what does that say about the God that you believe? Mm-hmm. You know, is that a God that you want to follow? Somebody that can't, you know, you can't confront your emotions with, you can't confront your questions, you know, and it has to be done in an honest way. You can't just cover it up. Like I was mentioning on my page, spiritual bypassing is a huge problem in the church, where, you know, you have these questions. Oh, but Jesus is in control. Oh, but I'm gonna get this. There's a thing called the hedge of protection, where you pray for this hedge of protection that your feelings would stay far away because they're deceptive. And all of that is just spiritual bypassing and not letting you go through what you're feeling, go through things that your spirit are telling you that's wrong. It's just like almost beating it into submission in a way that's in a lot of ways traumatic for people.
Yeah, and it's definitely this type of tactic to, like you're saying, veer you away from your spirit. You know, there's really not this difference between being godly and spiritual. You know, they're one and the same, but these structures put boundaries and walls, you know, within them. And it's kind of interesting. I want to get there later, but I do just want to kind of highlight and put this out in the air for our viewers, that we're not demoting Christianity itself, but we're highlighting and discussing the toxic traits of Christianity and how it relates to its relationship to patriarchy, toxic masculinity, and church trauma. And I think it is a conversation that needs to be discussed throughout borders, throughout cultures, throughout countries, you know, from the beginning of societies to societies now. And I'm loving that we are, people are wanting and willing to have these conversations and listen. Mm-hmm. One of my questions was talking about spirituality. You know, there's this kind of stigmatism or taboo type of energy where certain Christians think that using crystals or candles or sage, you know, certain kind of sages are foreign, or they're considered like witchcrafty voodoo rituals. But so you have that, which is literally you're using things from the ground, spirit, mother nature. Yet the rituals that are being done in the church, for example, communion and you know, all the drinking of the blood, I'm not like entirely savvy of the terms, but it's like, aren't those considered rituals and witchcrafty within Christianity? And it's like, yeah, like, do you guys want to confront that, or is it different because this is what you guys have known and it's Jesus is put on top of it, you know?
I think a lot of, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask, what are your thoughts on that?
So for me, I have a mentor who basically anything that was not Jesus, Jesus, Jesus was, and pardon me for being so blunt, satanic. So, you know, I like Harry Potter, crystals, oh my gosh, couldn't even think about that, you know, like Buddhism or Buddhism in the roots of like meditation, which meditating is a really, really great practice. you know, or yoga because of its Hindu roots, and all of these things that are amazing practices and amazing things that are just written off as satanic, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think what it is it's just a lack of understanding and a lack of truly opening yourself up to, you know, interfaith connection. Because for me, I'm a religion major. Like, I love all religion. So, and that was really, really hard to pursue, you know, being in a church that is very evangelical, because they're like, oh, well, if you're taking an Islam class, you need to pray before, you need to pray after. That's a dark, dark religion, because that's what everybody believes, because it's, you know, it's different. And for me, it was just so eye-opening. I was like, that's not what I believe. You know, there are beautiful people within that religion that are very valid in their faith. That's years and years and years of history, culture, study, you know, scholars within that one religion, and we're just going to write it all off as satanic. I think that's really ignorant, you know? And so when it comes to things like crystals and sage, I think that it's really easy for Christians, because in the Bible, it's like, only trust in the Lord, only do this. You know, it's very like, don't go wayward to idolatry and things of that nature, that anything that we don't understand, we want to immediately write off, you know, and we don't want to find validity in things that aren't common, don't make sense to us.
It's like this fear, I don't mean to cut you off, this fear yeah. of the unknown.
Right.
In that fear of the spiritual realm, how many movies have put out paranormal activity mm-hmm. and ghosts and kind of like programmed our minds to have this fear of the spiritual realm, when really this is an aspect of our being, like our bodies, our temples are the vessels, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But we are, you know, essentially like spiritual beings, and it, somewhere along the lines we lose touch with our inner essence and our core being when we're living in the ego, entirely in the ego or
yeah.
in certain structures, you know what I'm saying?
Right, absolutely. And I think that's just it. I think, you know, one of a question that we got on our Instagram was, or it wasn't a question, we did a Q&A, and somebody said, you know, I'll be praying for you guys because being too educated can lead you down a path of destruction, essentially, is what she was saying. And it just really struck a chord with me that, you know, why would we want to suppress ourselves to education? You know, that makes you very prone to cult-like behavior, you know, and it really keeps you ignorant and not gaining that skill in relating to one another and not gaining that skill of being honoring, you know, because God in his infinite wisdom, you know, is not ignorant, does not promote ignorance.
Right.
And I truly believe that, like, if you, and this is kind of, you know, I'm no longer evangelical, but they believe if be all things to all people, how can you be that if you actively suppress, you know, knowledge and wisdom from other religions? Not necessarily to convert if that's not what you want to do, but I can find just as much about a validity in Islam, Buddhism, as I do in Christianity, you know? And so that's kind of where people are really afraid to talk about, because they feel like that's so blasphemous. You know, and it's not. You know, I've sat with gurus at their temple. I've had very long conversations with them, done interviews through my studies, literally was taught by one of the top scholars in Islam. And I feel so thankful to have that information and so thankful to be able to see it, not from an apologetics view, which is, for lack of a better way to put it, just studying it to disprove it, but actually studying it to find beauty in it. You know, and then you start opening your mind to how much wisdom there is in things that you don't understand, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really my heart, is just to educate and say that things aren't scary. You know, you can walk in a way boldly and not be afraid, you know?
I definitely agree. And that's so great that you're doing that and people are coming to you guys and feeling safe and leaning in and being able to gain perspective, that opening their minds, you know what I'm saying, to such a closed dynamic and program. I think it's important to acknowledge too that, you know, ascension, you know, the term ascension, and I think in its relation to religion, in my experience or in some of my studies, I think, you know, that religion and all these different yoga practices are great tools and resources to help you in your journey, in your path towards ascension, because that is the goal, right? Even in Christianity, even in Buddhism and baptism, we want to have that relationship with God, with ourselves, with our higher power, with our intuition, and being able to be clear with that. And Christianity can be a great tool, you know, or whatever religion you practice, when you don't fall into the program structures that are closing down on from opening your mind, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And being more in your spirit. So I just wanted to that comment.
I agree with that a lot. You know, my mind goes to fasting, you know, and how fasting is an incredible tool. While I don't practice fasting in my, you know, pursuit to God, I know a lot of people do, but that's another way that can be used to, you know, bring yourself closer to God, not in an unhealthy way. You don't want to do that in a healthy way, but it is a tool used by many faiths, you know, and it is an expression. And so when we cut ourselves off to something like yoga, which was, you know, taught to essentially control your body and control your mind, in a way that brings freedom and healing. Mm-hmm. And we immediately cut it off because we don't understand it. And I think, you know, it is a tool. It can absolutely bring you closer to the divine. And I think, just when you are so literal and so stuck in one path, mm-hmm. it just closes you off to so much beauty and so much freedom, that you can use as expression in your own faith and your own pursuit towards God, you know?
Definitely. I heard you guys or read that you guys talked a little, both actually, I saw in your guys' Q&A and read a little bit about your guys' post on narcissistic leadership. Would you guys want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I was actually raised by a narcissist, a covert narcissist. And so that has been a very big point of me unlearning that toxic behavior my whole life. Mm-hmm. You know, narcissists have the golden child, the scapegoat, and then if they have a third, it's, you know, the backup golden child in case the golden child fails. So I was very much the scapegoat. So, you know, I was uncontrollable. I was kind of, you know, out there growing up. So we're almost in our 30s now, but it just, when I went to the church, it was so easy for me to dive right in because that was so familiar to me. And I clung to fundamentalist Christianity because it gave me so much structure that I was used to and made me feel the way that I was used to feeling. And I think a lot of people, you know, especially in evangelical culture, because the male is seen as the leader, which is a whole nother discussion.
And you might be able to touch on that when your husband comes in. I love
it. Yes. So it should be in a second. Baby's asleep. He's just teething.
No rush.
Really sad. are you about ready? Okay. So when, you know, the male is seen as the leader and it's not edified, you know, and you're weaponized by the Bible, which is the rules to life, you know, which nobody would actually admit that that's what they believe, but that's what they believe, you know. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, it's a guide. No, it's a rule book.
It's the suppression of the women the feminine energy. It's like this fear of her energy. And this is like, if we can suppress that, that she won't become more dominant or side by side, you know, with the men, because she is in all actuality powerful. She's the creator, you know. So there's this underlying deep, deep fear that has for centuries always, all governments have always tried to take away that power. For example.
And even when the Bible was written, it was in a patriarchal society. So like, when you believe in the inerrancy of scripture, it really takes away from the validity of women. You know, Jesus had women disciples, you know, the first preacher was a woman, and the everything, the way that it was written, you know, was very more bent toward men and men on top, and all of these things that, you know, it does suppress the woman and it does weaponize the man in the faith to, you know, practice that toxic masculinity without being held accountable. And that's really where I've struggled a lot, is because while I'm a woman, I have a very strong voice. You know, I am an Enneagram 7, very close to Enneagram 8. So when I became a Christian, I went from being very confident in my voice, very confident in myself, to feeling like I was wretched and my voice didn't matter. Not because I was told that. I mean, I was told that, but I had to be that nice, you know, feminine. I hated myself for my tattoos because women in the church didn't have tattoos. You know, I started getting tattooed when I was 18 before I converted to Christianity. So when I came to the church, it was total, like, I struggled, you know, I was not pure. I was not, if I can say, I was not a virgin when I came to the church. And so that already had set me back because of purity culture. I had tattoos. Christian women that were desirable didn't have tattoos, you know, and it was, it's like grooming you to become desirable to your future husband. And I could not stand alone in my confidence any longer, because my whole life was to then have a covering over myself from a man, you know, and
your authenticity, in having, being attached to other people's views and opinions of you, and being prepared for someone who isn't even pure themselves in thought, in mind, in spirit, you know. So that's really interesting, but I'm sure that's literally a confusion state to be in. Confusion is a choice, you know. You have the choice to stay in that, or when you're conflicted, your mind and your spirit is conflicted, you can stay in that and continue to battle yourself, or you can move forward, expanding and opening your mind, choosing to find clarity, because it's in you, it's in your higher power. But you're just, we're always being taught to do this, sit this way, instead of just be, and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And so back on narcissistic leadership, you know, for my experience, and, you know, I am in therapy. I love therapy. And a connection that we made, and she works through religious trauma, and something that she shared with me that I think is super beneficial to connect to and really assess if this is what you're going through, is when you are raised by an evangelical narcissistic leader within your own home. My husband just joined. We have the baby. He didn't want to get put down. So when you have that within your own home, when you go and see that reflected from the leadership in the church, and, you know, from the mentality that men are superior, that you need to listen to them, that you can't challenge them, that becomes the institution of the church, you know. And we are used to, and we don't recognize that narcissistic leadership because that's normal, you know. And how can you challenge what's normal and what's worked, I'm going to air quote, worked, you know, for centuries, you know, because it's reflected in our Bible. And that's really a whole nother thing, because the Bible was translated by men, you know, men with motive. And so when you hang on to that inerrancy of the literal translation, and don't reflect it back to the Greek, don't reflect it back to the culture, and who, you know, a lot of people bring up the passage in Timothy about how men are supposed to be superior over the woman, essentially. They didn't know that at that time the women were calling themselves goddesses because of another god that they believed. So that was specific to that church, you know, and also women weren't given access to education in that time the way they are now. So, you know, women should be quiet in the church. That's because they didn't have education the same way that men did. And so, of course, they were going to ask questions in the church. They didn't understand. But we take that with our cultural eyes, with the education that women now have access to. And we still believe that, oh, you know, women should be quiet in the church. Man is over the woman. All of these things that aren't right, you know, just breed this patriarchy that is not relevant to our culture anymore, was never relevant to the past culture in a lot of ways, but a specific people group, you know?
Oh, sure.
So that's where I really struggle with that whole thing.
It is definitely a conflicting place to be when you're challenging the norm. And it seems like when you're speaking of patriarchy, it really throws us off as individuals, males and females, because I mean, on an energetic level, we're made up of masculine and feminine energy. You know, the feminine meaning the spirituality, the being able to receive, and all the different components of each energy. And when you have a male so much in his masculine energy, you know, there is a natural imbalance that's going to, unhealthy imbalance that's going to occur. The same with the female. If there, she's entirely in her feminine energy, there's a very unnatural balance within her body. You know what I'm saying? So being able to bring back in some of the masculinity into her life and the creativity into the male's life, you know, I think that's what, you know, we should strive to, that should be the focus in our ascension or our spiritual path, is just balancing these types of energies and however people want to label feminine, masculine energies, we don't have to use those terms. But Christianity, I think, is definitely rooted in masculine energy, you know, and that's where we talk about toxic Christianity and its relation to patriarchy and toxic masculinity. And then we can talk a little even about white supremacy and its relation to that as well. Either of you guys want to take the lead in that topic?
Do you want to start, since you haven't?
I just wanted to add that, and I think this point's been made, but I don't think that we often hold it in tension, especially with how we view equality today. But, you know, so much of how Jesus treated women was so fundamentally different to the culture around him. He was very intentional, I feel like, of making sure that women were seen as valuable and important, and, you know, the very first people to be witnesses of the resurrection, you know, in the gospel accounts, were women. And, you know, I think that
so, he revealed who he was to a woman.
Right. Mm-hmm. Some of his closest friends, some of his closest followers were women. And I think that that's something that, you know, and even a lot of early church leaders, I think there, you know, there was one couple, Priscilla and Aquila, I can't remember because those names aren't as common. I can't remember which is the woman in that, but she was like the main leader of like a particular church. And so anyway, all I was trying to say is that I think the narrative of patriarchy, almost silenced a lot of those important themes within the New mm-hmm. Testament that were supposed to be countercultural to the time. And I think it's important for those specific things to be brought to light. And You know, there's that conversation of, you know, complementarianism or egalitarianism, and just so many strange perspectives.
Complementarianism, sorry, I cannot say it very well, is the belief that men are, men and women have separate roles. That complement each other but aren't equal. Egalitarianism. Thank you. I cannot say these words. They're like
okay. There's a lot of words that I have to.
Right. But it essentially means that men and women are equal.
A lot of evangelical Christianity promotes complementarianism that says that the man's the head of the house, he is to be,
but the woman has a role as well, you know,
right? It's just the man's to make the decision, he's have the final say, he's the leader of the home, yada yada yada. And you know, I think our marriage is a perfect example of how we have very different sort of typical gender roles, or like I'm the feeler, I'm more sensitive, and she's
I handle more, the bills, I'll hang something up with a hammer, you know, just very traditionally different.
Well, there's a balance still taking place that's yoked within your relationship. I'm sure you still have feminine energy presence that occurs with his masculine traits, you know, but as far as the main roles like you're talking about, you might be better at that and vice versa, you know. Right. So yeah. I think that works. That's amazing.
Yeah, so it's just funny how not funny, it's actually sad how this narrative has been pushed and has forced relationships to fit a particular mold where people's strengths maybe aren't to operate in a particular manner that fit into this or complementarian mentality. So anyway, egalitarianism I think is growing in prominence for many good reasons, but you know, I think that any relationship that fundamentally agrees that each of your role is equally important in the relationship succeeding and in the family being healthy is how it should be, for a number of reasons. I mean, you know, not that we even have to go this route, but like even if you look at, you know, the creation account, whether you read that literally or whether you read that figuratively, you can still see that the language in that account makes a very good case that God created both man and woman in that story of being equal, like made them both in his image. It wasn't like man was created in God's image, but woman was created as an afterthought or whatever it was. You know, it just, so anyway.
Yeah. But I did want to circle back to white supremacy.
There's so many components we could for 20 minutes, but it all really comes back to, it's all interconnected. So
yeah. Well, I think patriarchy and white supremacy go hand in hand. And a lot of my studies have been around colonialism and missions. And that really is what made me do the biggest about face with evangelical Christianity and wanting, honestly, not like I had to stop reading my Bible, stop going to church for many years to just kind of go through this grieving process of what I learned was so suppressive, or it in nature, it's not suppressive. It's actually supposed to be incredibly beautiful. But the way that it's been weaponized and used against the beauty of different cultures, like I could cry because this is literally my biggest passion. And kind of going back to that ignorance of what I was talking, we don't want to take time to understand things that are not literal in the text, Christianity, and in a very large fashion. And so, you know, when colonizing began, especially in Africa, I did a case study on Zululand, so the Zulu people, and how Norwegians came and they started evangelizing the Zulu people, And they had a month calendar. You know, they didn't have a week calendar, the 7 days in a week. They had round houses, not square houses. But when the evangelicals came, or, you know, I'm sorry. Okay. The way that they...
I wouldn't even consider them evangelicals. They were just Protestants, because evangelicalism... Mm-hmm.
It didn't exist pretty much at that point, but that's what they were doing. They were going and evangelizing for conversion. And so when they went, it was, you know, they brought culture. And so when we look at what happened and the journals of that time and of those people that came and infiltrated the culture of Zululand, you start seeing all of these rectangular houses popping up, and they would build their land, and then they would tax anybody who went through their land. And the Zulu people now could not have their own land because it was owned by the church, essentially, with their square houses. And then they started having staff within that, and they had to dress a certain way if they went to their school, you know, to learn about Jesus. And so in reading these journals from the Norwegians, it was so much about how much they were sacrificing because they didn't even have a couch in their home, and, you know, all of these things, while you're literally taking away the beauty of the African culture. Mm-hmm. And so what ended up happening was these letters that were being sent back to their church, the church was giving them to the government, and it was aiding in the colonization that was about to happen there. And so they used that as an in to then colonize. And so you can't separate colonization and missional work. And I think that's the hardest thing for me. You know, right now there's a church sending people over to these unreached people groups. I can't remember exactly where they're located, in a pandemic. And they're going and they're preaching the gospel to these, this beautiful culture that has never heard of Jesus before, which a lot of evangelicals would be like, yes, by the grace of God, you're doing amazing work. But it's, take your blinders off and see what you're doing. You are using
a structure and infrastructure within the economy and the society, but they're bringing in Jesus. They're bringing in God as a power mechanism. You know, it's exactly. Like what you're really needing is an economy. They're really needing an education and healthcare systems and to sustain that. Yet here you're dropping in, you're just coming in, mixing up some salad, and then leaving and considering that mission work. Right. And, Americans, we are very much guilty of that. I was 2 years in Egypt and I was teaching, and I was really able, but it takes place across the world, in South America and Africa. And you're really able to sit back and observe the intentions and the integrity of the intentions and agenda in these mission trips and these, you know, across the world. And how are you helping to sustain this, this community, really, you know?
I think, you know, with that, you know, the ethnocentrism, I think, is the right term for that. Because Christianity boomed in Europe, and that's where a lot of the history is, even though it was birthed out of the Middle East.
I want to get to that in a second. I'm let you finish.
But it whitewashed this diverse worldview that should have been something that was radically inclusive. And, you know, you have the culmination of the scriptures, and however you want to understand the apocalyptic literature that is Revelation, that is very fuzzy,
it is so fuzzy,
widely disputed, and even the last included book in the canon that the early church fathers said we shouldn't have any formal doctrine around, but that's another story. The reality is this, it culminates with every tribe, every nation, every tongue. And even at the birth of the church in Pentecost, you see all these different languages together gathered in one place. And it's this picture of diversity, But as it became a state-sanctioned religion within Rome, and that being like such an epicenter for like kind of this whitewashing of Christianity and turning it into this marriage between empire and religion, it became synonymous with conquering. And then you have the Inquisition, and you have all these things, or the Crusades and all these horrible things that war, just war theory, and all these things that came in and started to be inextricable from this gospel of peace that was meant to bring people together and unite people and be about celebrating diversity and celebrating heritage and celebrating people's unique background and ethnicity. And so for some reason, when all that happened, this narrative of conquer and take over became synonymous with Christianity. And that's why nationalism and white supremacy and all these things are such dangerous things that we're seeing creep up again, with evangelicalism being married with conservative nationalism. And this weird,
especially in these past 4 years, again, don't want to get too political, but it has been, just in our friendships that we've seen alone, I think we've lost more friendships this year than we have in so long, because we are unlearning, should I say, nationalist Christianity, because you can't be an American Christian and say you're not a national, or you have to actively unlearn, is what I'm trying to say.
I wouldn't say that you you can't be a Christian.
Right. It's the process of unlearning. If you were institutionalized by the church, if you have learned by the church your whole life, you have to actively unlearn ways that the American nation has been put on a pedestal in America.
And for people who are challenging and unlearning and relearning actual facts that have always been there but covered up, it creates this huge mistrust in our society, in our government, in this white supremacist culture. Because we look at the textbooks and the doctors, and their discoveries have been overrided with people who have not innovated and discovered those very things. And they came in and said, for example, we discovered this first, but there's history and there's textbooks that were clearly educated. And it's not about it's not about who discovered it, but why are we giving this, labeling this information, these discoveries, to the colonizers? Why are we saying that they discovered this? And the same with Jesus. If Christianity essentially derived in Africa, or you're saying in Europe, that makes people, who's going to believe what color was Jesus? Because Jesus was in Africa, and everyone there is very much darker skinned, there's more melanin present. So where did it change to Jesus, and why Jesus is this white model, or what is the word I'm looking for, figure? Why did we make it about color? Is it for when we see these people with lighter skin, that already sets the tone of they're superior because they're looked at as godly, versus, do you know what I'm saying? And it's like that's where a lot of it started and derived from, this white supremacist culture,
Yeah, if you share an image of Jesus as white to an unreached people group and you say, this is God, and you look like that picture, the unreached people group, or the people who have never seen an image of Jesus before that you're bringing to them, immediately it brings out white supremacy. Oh, you must trust me more. It makes you like God. And I think that is just, it's power, it's a misuse of power. Mm-hmm. And it's I think abuse. Thank you. Like one of the worst offenses. And I actually like posted something about this not too long ago. And people were sitting there debating the color of Jesus on, you know, this post and how like, oh no, it wasn't done because of, you know, supremacy and all of these things. And it, but it absolutely was, because how can you take Jesus, who very obviously was dark-skinned because of where he was located geographically, and argue that his change in color was not because of white supremacy? There's just no way that you can argue that. You know, there have been books written about it. There have been, you know, articles, all of these things. And it just all comes back to, there is no argument other than control, other than abuse of power. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as white people in the church that have, I've firsthandedly seen the way that, you know, I did missions in my early 20s, very big cringe moment for me. The way that the word has been weaponized. I now on the other side see the great importance of us dismantling it. You know, our job is not to decolonize, because that is Black people's jobs, and we are there to push their voices forward, because as white people, we can't relate to what's going on in a lot of ways. It's kind of like that thing, we can't understand, but we will do every effort in our power to understand. Mm-hmm. And so this woman named Jo Lumen, she's a person of color in the church, and she, oh my gosh, I love her so much. And so she released a thing about what our rules are as far as white people in the church and people of color in the church. And I have very much identified as a person of dismantling rather than decolonizing, because at the point of decolonizing, that's saying that we know better again, you know? So our job is to point to people of color, to push them forward in the fight, and us keeping people behind in check so that they can keep on doing their work, you know? And
what do you mean push forward in a fight?
So, you know, kind of when the whole thing happened with George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter rise again, a lot of books were being sold about oppression by white people. And it's, again, amplifying that white voice and that white experience. So it's that phrase, amplifying Black voices and people of color's voices, and making sure that we're not taking away an our white experience from what needs to be said. And so providing resources and providing things that are the Black experience, that are the people of color's experiences, and amplifying that over what we have to say.
Yeah, and that sense of education and spreading awareness is a part of the fight. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's a part Absolutely. Of the allyship and being mm-hmm. on the front lines and being the cover of what... you know what I'm saying? It's a community thing. It's a humanitarian, is that the word I'm looking for? Effort, but also being who is on the front lines spreading the awareness, who's going to be listened to more or understood more? Whose job is it to point out the facts and the information? You know, is it a mm-hmm. collective fight, or is it, you know what I'm saying, is it a racial fight, and who sits back, and who, you know what I'm saying, and who pushes forward? You know, you see racism prevalent even within the Asian culture, within the African culture, and the darker the skin in the Asian culture or Latin culture is, you know, they start to like feel inferior and like kind of like dislike themselves, you know, being less in the sun, when really the sun is so like helpful to our health. You know, it's just this weird mind-boggling brainwash thing it all really comes down to suppress our spirit. You know, we have food that we pray over that is energy and goes into our body to nourish us, and even that is disrupting our spiritual connection. And when you finally are able to sit back and look at all the dots and how they connect, which this period of quarantine has in this pandemic has been a blessing, because we're able to, I mean, you have to sift through the energy, not the energy, the information that's being presented to you and see what resonates. But it's been a blessing to be able to come home and sit in your space and decompress. And it gives us all an opportunity to feel what resonates, what's right with the information that's being presented to us, you know, and connect on a community level, you know, and share resources, which who knows how long these resources, you know, we already have independent fact checkers being presented, but who knows how long this information will be available in our textbooks, on the internet, as more information is being spread, you know, when are they going to come in and put boundaries on this new level, on this new era of information, because we're in an era of knowing and not just knowledge. You know what I'm saying? There's a clear, you got to be able to discern that the difference between them. Knowing is within yourself, and there's a lot of knowledge out there that you can regurgitate, but what's true? What's factual? You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
All right, we're not a tangent.
No, it's all so amazing. And I think that kind of like goes back to, you know, who are we going to choose to amplify in this time? Are we going to choose to amplify more white voices, you know, in this race war? Are we going to choose to amplify Black brothers and sisters? And I, you know, in educating myself and becoming a better ally, you know, I've done a lot of studies on colonization and a lot of studies on, you know, missions and their effects on countries and their effects on white supremacist mindset, you know, because if you're told you have to go over to a traditionally Black continent and evangelize to them, well, that immediately in your mindset gives you a supremacy right there, you know. And so reading a lot of case studies on college-aged or high school-aged students that go over and do these missions, and seeing how, you know, sometimes they'll get over there and they'll be disappointed because they thought that they would be, you know, in a complete impoverished, no homes, you know, they just have this mindset of what it's about because it's that image that we've been given, you know, in the church, like, oh, they need Jesus, they need to go and be reached. And no, like, Africa's a beautiful continent. You know, like, there are hotels, there's homes, there's, you know, businesses, there's all of these things. Like, I have, there's functionality there. It's not just, you know, what is in the mind of people who want to go and evangelize there. So, I, you know, doing studies around that, it's like, I don't want to sit here and learn from people who have that mindset or had that mindset. I need to learn from people who have experienced it and who have gone through that firsthandedly, you know, and I think that that's so important in a time of, you know, great censorship, if we want to talk about it, or, you know, a multitude of voices, to choose the right ones and focus on the right ones. And in this time right now, that's just not white people talking about their experience of being not racist, which is a whole nother thing.
It's, you know, this defensive thing. It's like, this shouldn't be turning into another civil or racial war. Like, we need to, which we are seeing people come together, but this is an educational, you know, battle where both races need to come and present facts of what's happened and what is happening and what's repeated itself, you know, from vaccines to political levels. You know, it's just information, education is so needed, and it's not a time to divide, you know, and fight each other because of the color of our skin, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Did you want to say something? I'm sorry.
I know, we're just rambling. Please chime in with any of your thoughts.
That's the hard part of being an Enneagram 8. I will just like talk and talk and talk, and then I'll like take all of his points. So
Is there anything that you'd like to add that we've kind of brushed over?
I think one thing that I was thinking through as I was saying that is, you know, I think in churches right now, you look to leaders on how to handle a lot of, you know, civil rights situations. And, you know, in what's happening this year specifically, I have seen a huge lack in responsibility taken amongst churches. You know, they posted the black square and they moved on, you know, and there was no real systems put in place of education, accountability, understanding white supremacy in the church, and how incredibly important it is to decolonize and dismantle scripture, and how it is used as a weapon continually. And so I think that's something that is really important and really needs attention, is to, you know, provide that education if you're going to claim to be the solution.
Oh, definitely. You know?
Yeah, so that's where I've been really struggling and looking to leaders to see what their next move is, you know, because it's not, it can't just be, oh, another black man got killed. Let's ride in the streets and then let's go back home and forget. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not the answer. It will never be the answer. It needs continual attention because for years it has not been given attention that it needs. And so the only solution from this point forward, and honestly from the beginning forward, is to continue to bring attention to that.
Injustice as well.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people don't see that as something that, you know, as long as you're teaching the Bible isn't racist. So as long as we're Bible-believing Christians and seek the word and understand that God is justice and all of these things, well, that's not really the answer, because that's a scapegoat. That's pushing off responsibility and just being like, oh, the word will give us answers. For years, it hasn't. For, like, since we have colonized America, it has not.
People go to it as a form, you know, to want to give their power away to be healed, like we give our power away to doctors, you know, and some words can have healing power and elements to it, but you give your power away when you go to this source outside of yourself.
Absolutely.
You guys' main, you know, not main focus, but one of the focuses, church recovery, church trauma recovery. What, besides the way that you guys are going about it now, which I think is amazing, providing this platform, this educational platform, what do you guys see in the future and the vision of this project for people to come? What does the church trauma recovery look like within your guys' mission?
Yeah, I think that truthfully, this is something that we are navigating as we go. Mm-hmm. I think we didn't realize, tapping into it, just how important of a conversation this really was until we drew attention to it. And we haven't been the first ones to do that. But to answer your question truthfully, I think that we need to have these tough conversations within local churches. We had a couple comments from pastors come on our page and actually be like, you know, I'm a pastor. Thank you for doing this. This is important. Mm-hmm. We need more of that, to where pastors aren't afraid to admit where they've got it wrong.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it needs to start from the top down. And I hate even saying that, but mm-hmm. I think it communicates what I'm trying to get across.
I'm so sorry.
That from an institutional perspective, the only way that change can happen is if those who are leading these local churches begin to say, how am I contributing to the pain of individuals and communities? How can we be, how can we reevaluate being affirming in our church? How can we be standing alongside of BIPOC, you know, the community, to where they feel like their voice matters, their pain matters, their story matters. And I think it's really calling attention to the margins and saying that the people that you're claiming belong actually don't feel like they belong. And you acting like you're a place that loves God and loves people, you're not doing that if you're excluding.
Yeah.
And in order to create a real unity and real love within the church and within the world, we have to be willing to acknowledge how we are causing the pain.
Holding ourselves accountable.
Right. And I think that there's this holier than thou, untouchable, can't be wrong mindset, because people want to justify exclusion, again, weaponizing the Bible, to where it ends up looking completely anti-Jesus. I'll give you a perfect example. This actually makes me so angry, but there was a Christian clothing company. There's an ad that popped up on a friend's Facebook and he shared it with me. It was of a shirt that said, "Jesus loves you." Christians were up in arms about that message. Oh, you can't say Jesus loves you. That's not the gospel.
Would a judge tell their defendant or whatever that, or
you need to tell them that they're guilty and they're sinners so that they know that they're wrong?
Would a judge tell them that you love them? So it just...
There's a polarization that's happening right now within the church of people who are clinging tighter to hatred and division and the toxicity that is Calvinism. Being someone who was within that, I don't know how familiar you are with that theology.
Calvinism, let's do a sidestep real quick, is believing in the elect, so that you believe that God, before time, essentially, predestined specific souls to be saved and others to perish.
Tormented in eternal flames.
Right. So you have no say over whether you're getting saved or not. God's already decided. So it's just a very...
Again, derived from power and control almost.
It's an abuse of power. And
But a lot with that, there's this horrible heritage of, or I can't think of a better word, like ancestry of theologians and thinkers who were trained in law. And so they have a very legal perspective and they view everything through a legal lens. And so there's a large majority of Christians that think sinners are people who have committed a grave injustice against a holy God and they need to be punished. Sin needs to be punished. And it's this punitive, retributive mindset of justice that ends up painting God to be this wrathful, angry being who needs to have his anger appeased by a blood sacrifice. And anyway, I don't want to go too far down a tangent, but to be in a place in the church to where we can be so cold-hearted to think that Jesus loves you is a dangerous message.
An offensive.
Like, are you actually like is there something wrong?
It's like they're coming from this extremist nature.
Yeah.
Like you're not even within your spirit anymore. You're not even in tune with your being. You're entirely in your ego and in the society structures that have been told that you've been listening to.
Yeah.
You know. And that's where you see in like the political and the wars, like people become, you know, Islam has been kind of like demonized from the Western world. I mean, it is one of the newest religions, but because of the political wars that have been going on in the Middle East, you know, but you have the extremists and then you have the people who are just in their faith learning, just in their faith. And it's the same with Christianity, of the extreme Christianity, Christians who seem a little bit more political than actually in touch. Huh?
that's where nationalism comes into play. Yeah. I'm by no means an expert, but if I were to recommend someone, there's a brilliant author, and he's also a pastor. His name's Brian Zond, and he's someone who's called attention to this growing corrosive, just honestly, this movement or whatever of nationalism that's risen and become synonymous with American Christianity. And it's sad because, again, you have so many outspoken Christians who support a particular political movement and make these strange allusions to biblical fulfillment of this leader being the chosen one and the anointed one by God, and like excuse mm-hmm. behavior, excuse allegations, and all these things. And there's so much cognitive dissonance happening that's causing people to be blind to clear, overt, narcissism, overt bigotry.
It's like a loss of moral compass. How are you using which sin is superior or inferior in, you know what I'm saying? Why are they all in different pedestals if all sins are sins? You know what I'm saying? And that doesn't even make sense. So why are you going into that confusion, you know, in that state of confusion? But they'll try to justify it and how it makes sense.
Well, it really is like a learned skill to be able to debate and disagree and think outside of yourself. And I feel like Christianity has really missed the mark in teaching that skill. And, you know, because it's so funny because on our Instagram, every time I hear somebody say, well, the word clearly says, I can guarantee before I click on their page, it's a high schooler. And every single time it's like something high school 2022, you know, and you know, that's not all of them. A lot of them are other zealous young evangelicals. But it is like the more you, I don't want to say the more that you are closed off to other things, because there are many, many adults who do this. I am so sorry. But it is a learned skill to be able to do these things. I'm going to scoot you up just a little bit. Nothing more feminist than
this is live, so it's totally, I have a little one, she's just not here with me at the moment.
But you know, it's all about taking off that hierarchy mindset of Christianity on top, which, you know, the faith teaches, and I don't want to say the faith, but a lot of leaders teach. And choosing to put yourself intentionally second and like learning and relating and seeing validity. And so with our Instagram, it's not, we don't hate Christians. We don't hate Christianity. Right. It is all about flipping the narrative on its head and talking about sin from a different angle. Again, have a hard time with that word. But sin from a different angle of, you know, oh my gosh. The church as the institution is not above being called out. And a lot of people are like, oh, you're going to lead people astray with this message that you're sending about the church. And it's like, no, I'm not. No, and if they get led astray, it's not because of what we've posted. It's because the church has failed to do the job of holding herself accountable for years. And so when we call out things that are very, very necessary, and in a lot of cases, life or death with some people, it's not going against Christianity. It's wanting better for her. You know, and it's doing so as a great call to action for churches and Christians to understand the harm and the mental trauma that they're causing so many people without knowing, because it's this mindset of, well, if they're hurt, they were just given the truth. And so they need to deal with it. You know, that's not it. You know,
the truth is so like inherently triggering, you know, you notice to those living in an illusion.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where you start to see when people start to resist the truth you're conveying. And I mean, whether your truth is subjective or objective, sometimes the truth is just the truth. And when you notice people start to be like triggered toward it, it makes you kind of think like, well, what reality, what perspectives are you holding and clinging on to? But like you guys are saying, like, we definitely need to hold our pastors and our leaders more accountable. And if they're, you're really humble out here doing these charity works and giving and mission works, have humility within yourself and then the people following you to be able to discern, is spirit leading you like you claim you are called to be, in the same discernment of being able to be teachable, you know, to new information, or it's not even new information, but against the status quo, you know what I'm saying? I mean, Jesus went into all different countries and different, you know, in different eras, they all thought different things. So you're going to send a message that's resonating with that era, with that time, with that society, but it's all the same thing. It's like the game of telephone, it's being twisted into society's box of how you can be controlled, but the message was the same in all of those, you know, he gave the language to the people that could understand it, you know. But yeah, to the pastors, you know, the ones that are, you know what I'm saying, the ones that aren't wanting to go outside that box and teach what needs to be taught are the ones that need to be very much held accountable. And that's what I really appreciate your guys' work. And I really love what you guys are doing with the community. And if you guys can connect more with pastors and they have you on board with them and coming, I think that's going to be a really great, great thing.
Yeah, we're really excited. I really believe that it's time. And I call it like the second reformation. I believe it's time for a second reformation in the church. And you know, the abuse of power that she's been heaping on, you know, people outside the church, people in the church. It's just, it's time for the institution to wake up to the harm that they're causing through this stance of arrogance and narcissism. And, you know, again, I don't want to lump every leader into that, but as a whole, that's the message that's being received by many countries, not just America.
There will be resistance because it's embedded in subconscious, and you know what I'm saying, but it's, how long did it take us for us to relearn, deprogram our minds? You know, it can happen once we're presented with information that challenges
people's thoughts.
And that's the route that we need to go, you know.
Yeah, to walk boldly in confidence in whatever questions you have and whatever feelings you have, and find validity in that, regain a sense of understanding within yourself and connect back to yourself.
That's exactly, you know, what I was going to say. Like that is goal, is to not have a sense of, give your power outside of yourself, like to be connected with yourself and your source. And, you know, you're not idolizing these multiple gods. There's nothing wrong with being in tune with yourself, you know, and thinking for yourself. Encouraging people to live in their authenticity and confidence within themselves is the ultimate.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I think we could probably, of course, go on topic for hours and hours and hours, but I really appreciate you guys coming in. I love your guys' name, the Heretics. I think that's so clever, and it really sounds heroic. I was telling your wife, it sounds like heroic, and the funniest, not in a funny way, but just being empowered by it, you know, is how you guys turned it around, is heroic.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much for joining the podcast. Yeah. I really appreciate you guys' insight, and I wish you guys luck and blessings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you navigating the real life with us. We have our oldest at preschool, but this one is a whole nother story. So we really appreciate you making space for him as well and going with our crazy in the midst of everything, because this is whole life.
Yeah, and we're in quarantine and we're in a pandemic, so you just gotta do what you gotta do. So I totally understand, and all the followers will as well, and I'm sure they'll find it's relatable, so it makes it more
life, for sure.
That's what we gotta do. I mean, so much I feel like, even with social media, and
paints a perfect picture,
right? I mean, at the end of the day, like, it's about making people feel like they can connect with people who are real and they don't have everything, all their shit together. You know, really, it's about really just, we're all in this together. We're all, you know, we're all figuring
more out. Pressure and more instability to try to hold it all together. You know, like, right. There's a lot of instability and emotional instability that takes place when there's a facade present.
Yeah. You know,
saying you're always constantly pressured to either recreate new identities because one has failed, because you can't keep it up for so long. So it's like this constant identity crisis, when it's like, just be honest with yourself. You know, there's this life and it's not always pretty.
Wouldn't that be
more
nice?
Times than not.
Right. Well, you guys have a great rest of the day.
Thank you
for giving us this opportunity to talk and meet with you. You have so much wisdom and insight too, so it was so nice just learning from one another and talking.
Definitely.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah.
Definitely. Thank you. I'm definitely going to be following yours as Paige Moore, and we'll have to stay connected with projects or anything that comes up. I'd really love to work with you guys in some sense in the future.
Sure. Well, we always have that door open. So,
all right, you guys take care. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
See you later.
Bye.